nobody has put better watches in front of more people than John Mayer over the years. Like, it's just a fact. There's not anybody. And then you have like a connoisseur, like an actual academic in Goldberg. These are the guys that laid the foundation, right? I mean, this was episode number one and number three, I believe, with JJ in between. You know, I hesitate to say, to use this word about anything we've ever done, but like, these are iconic videos. You know, these are things that like, you know, have shaped the collecting culture over the last 7 years.
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulvern, and this is Hodinkee Radio. It's been a pretty big week in watch news, from new releases to watch spottings to trade show updates, and there are absolutely no sign of things slowing down anytime soon either. First up this week, we've got, you guessed it, some more news. This week's episode is dropping on April 20th, which is the same day that the FHH is announcing that Watches and Wonders Geneva, which used to be known as SIHH, is still going to happen. It's just going to happen online instead of in person. Now, last week, I spoke with FHH Chairwoman and Managing Director Fabienne Lupo to get the full scoop on what that actually means, why it's important for the watch industry to stick together, and what all of this might mean for the future of the industry. Last week also saw the end of Watch Madness, our Talking Watches Bracket Challenge. There's so much to discuss there, so I got James and Ben on a video call so that we could just hash it all out. We talk about our favorite matchups, the votes that we found hardest to cast, and dive really deep into the final few rounds. We also share some personal thoughts, though, on what Talking Watches means to each of us and where we hope it goes from here. Finally, taking us home this week, we've got our own John Buse sharing how a classic travel watch became his unlikely work-from-home companion over these past few weeks. There's a ton to fit into this week's episode. It's all fantastic. So without further ado, let's do this. Good to talk to you, Fabienne. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Contained, but I'm fine.
It's been a pretty big week for you this week. We're recording this on Friday. You're probably pretty excited for the weekend.
Yes, at last we have the weekend, but I think it will be a busy weekend also, because we have big announcement also next week, so a lot of interviews and meetings to still have to be ready on time.
Yeah, I'm sure. So that big announcement is why we're here, is to talk about that. But before we get into that, I think, you know, you're the managing director of the FHH, and I think for some of our audience, maybe the only thing that they know the FHH from is Watches and Wonders and SIHH, but you guys do a whole lot more than just that. So I was wondering if you could just start by kind of telling people what the FHH is and what you guys do.
Yes, of course. So the FHH is a Fondation de la Haute Horlogerie. So it's like a Foundation High Horology in English. And this foundation is a private foundation founded already 15 years ago by three founders, Richemont Group, Audemars Piguet and Gérard Perregaux, now from the Kering Group. And this foundation has been founded to promote the culture and know-how about fine watchmaking worldwide. Because at that time, it was very difficult to understand really what was the definition of fine watchmaking. So one of the main objective of this foundation, it was to set a kind of definition, and we did maybe something that you have heard about called the white paper of fine watchmaking, giving a definition of what we consider like a part of the perimeter of fine watchmaking, and within this perimeter, the ambition of the FHH is to promote the know-how, the expertise about this excellence evidence about this this fine watchmaking know-how and brands and creation and innovation. So we are a kind of ministry of fine watchmaking, if I may, because our mission is really to spread the words and to raise awareness about this fantastic industry, the know-how that there is behind it, and incredible capacity of innovation and the incredible products and novelties that they are presented all year long, and for that we have developed different activities, and let's say we have two main activities. The first one is about information and education. Because we, as an institution for promoting fine watchmaking, we have this mission to educate and to transmit and to explain. So we have set an academy, the FHH Academy, and this is one of our main missions. So information and education, and the second one maybe it's more well known. It's about the organization of big shows and fairs, and like the SIHH during 30 years now, and now. The SIHH, as you know, has become the Watches and Wonders event, and now we are working to extend this brand, creating a real ecosystem of Watches and Wonders worldwide.
One of the things that's really fascinating to me about what the FHH does is that it crosses groups and it crosses brands. So much of what happens in the watch industry is so segmented, right? Like LVMH does their thing, Richemont does their thing, Kering does their thing. But it's you're really working across the big groups and also the independent brands. And even in my time in the industry, you know, over the last, 7-8 years, SIHH expanded from being only sort of member brands to also including independents. How do you find working across those groups can sort of like elevate the whole industry as opposed to everybody kind of trying to do their own thing?
Yes, I think, Frank, we are in a quite small community. Finally, frankly speaking, this business is not a huge one. It's a very niche business, and so it's important to be together, to gather all the initiative, all this maison, because we will be stronger together. And I think the mission of the foundation is to have this transversal approach and to be a really, a kind of referent, a kind of authority, a kind of voice of the profession. And this is really important because, this is clearly our mission, and it's not necessarily easy to do so sometimes, because all these brands are also competitors, but what we want is really to raise awareness among connoisseurs, among the general public, among people who don't know necessarily a lot about fine watchmaking, and maybe some people are curious and they want to be more informed, more educated.
Well, that's a great way to bring us to kind of our main topic today, which is in a year where we've seen show after show get canceled or quote unquote postponed. You know, I don't quite think it's postponement if it's 10 months, but that's a separate topic. But in that climate, you guys are actually announcing today that Watches and Wonders 2020 will happen. It's just going to happen online instead of in person, right?
Yes, we will try to, because it's always very difficult to replace such a beautiful, such a amazing show. Especially as it was planned for this year, because it was a new formula, as you know. Watches and Wonders 2020 was supposed to be a new format. more open to the public, especially with the program we put together in the city. You know that we plan to right. have beside the salon in Palexpo, we plan to have a big programmation, a kind of festival of fine watchmaking in the city of Geneva, with exhibitions, with live demonstrations, with workshops, with conferences, with visit of manufacture, with big happenings. Around education, around showing once again the behind the scene of our industry, and so this this version was supposed to be very different and more open than the previous one. So of course it will be difficult to do so online, but the idea is really to create this this platform, whatisandwonders.com, to present especially for the in the first step at the dates where the show was supposed to be, that is to say 25 April to 29. The idea was to especially unveil the novelties and the products and the launches and big announcement of the exhibiting brands or the participating brands, we will say now, because they are no more exhibiting physically. But the idea was is really with this platform to be a portal for the brands to present their novelties as they would have do during the physical event in Geneva, and the first audience for this first phase, let's say, it's more the first circle of the community of the salon. So there are for retailers, for journalists, but also for clients, for VIPs, for all the community of Watches and Wonders that used to come at the show. So this will be the first phase of the launch of this platform, but as you said, the ambition of the, of this platform is much more than that. This will be the first step. Then the idea is really to become a kind of a flagship of the Watches and Wonders ecosystem, showing showing the actuality, showing presenting the content created by the FHH as an educational perspective, but also point of view of some experts. You were mentioning earlier the Cultural Council of the FHH. Yeah. We are gathering around 50 experts around the world. Some are retailers, some are journalists, some are experts, some are people from museums, some are collectors. And so we have a big diversity of these different key opinion leaders, let's say, of the industry in this Cultural Council. And of course, we will ask them to give their input, their insights about the novelties, about the actuality, about some, let's say, business topics that we want to tweet, that we want to go deeper, for instance, about I don't know, like the sustainability approach in watchmaking, and the sourcing, the innovation, the e-commerce also, the business transformation. So this is really the kind of subject we want to cover within this platform with our experts and with our community.
Yeah, that's all great. I think that's really interesting to see it happen, you know, sort of for the first time, the new Watches and Wonders, new SIHH, happening virtually, because, you know, the goal of reaching more consumers and having this be more than just sort of press releases and press conferences is really fascinating to me. I wonder if you think that the future of Watches and Wonders and the future sort of watch trade shows, if we can call them trade shows anymore, is more content focused and is more consumer focused, as opposed to just being a place for retailers to place their orders and for, you know, folks like me to go shoot pictures and write stories.
Yeah, no, you're right, and this is the point about the format and the definition and the objective of this old trade show, because during 25 years, I think the SIHH was a private and professional show, so a trade show.
Right.
But now, as I said before, the business has changed a lot. We assist at the retailization of the distribution. We assist to the rise of the e-commerce. We have a big change in the profile of the clients, the way to talk to them. You know, now the new media, the online, the influencers. So now the way to do business and to sell watches has changed a lot, and we had to adapt, and the shows had to adapt also, because a show finally is nothing else than a kind of media. So he has to do also his big transformation as media had to do. And it's why with SIHH and now the Watches and Wonders show, we want to address all these different audiences. And this is not easy to do, because of course, when you want to treat in the same place and the same momentum, a business audience with retailers, press, and a general public audience or customer-oriented audience with end clients, with general public, with young generation that you want to onboard in fine watchmaking. It's really difficult to address all this audience with the same format of salon. So yeah. It's why we had this this move and this change since a few years now with the SIHH, and especially with the new with the ambition of the new version of Watches and Wonders event, it's really to of course still continue to serve the industry and the retailers, because we cannot forget that maybe depending on the brands, but some brands are still doing 50% of their business with retailers. So they need to have a professional platform, a trade platform to meet, to present their novelties to their distributors. So it's still a necessity, but it's no more sufficient. Now you need also a platform where you can address with the press, and no more only the professional press, but the general public press, the lifestyle press, the influencers, the KOL. Yeah. You have a new range of media, of prescriptors that you have to invite and to treat also if you organize this kind of salon. So this is the second audience, and then the last one, and maybe the most important one, because finally it's the one that will buy the products, the watches, they are the clients, the end clients,
right.
The customers, and now this is quite new for us to treat directly this kind of customer, because at the very beginning the brands didn't know really well the customers, because more of them used to not having direct link with the end customer, because they were selling through their distributors, retailers.
Right.
So now it's something new And for them, it's really important to build a relationship with their hand clients. And it's why these shows and the Watches and Wonders show is also a unique occasion to demonstrate the brands, the DNA of the brands, the product, the history of the brand, the vision of the brand. And we are doing this transformation. We are like the fashion week for watches, you know. At the very beginning, the fashion weeks were only for the press and for the profession. They were trade approach. Now they are more and more with end customer, with big clients, because yes, today it's really important to have this direct link with your client. So yeah. Today we have this fantastic platform, which is the physical event in Geneva, because we can say it, it's the most beautiful show in the world. So of course, it would be a pity not to use this beautiful setup to invite the hand customers and to present the novelties and to treat them. So for them, it's a privilege to be invited on such event, and yeah. And it's why we want to continue, and we are sure that the momentum also of April, it's more interesting for them, because the products will be also sooner in the boutiques. Right. The time to market is more interesting in April than in January. So yeah. all these things make that we really believe in this new formula of this show, which is more a celebration of the watchmaking excellence than a trade show as it used to be. And yeah, it's why
that's a good way to put it, the idea of a celebration of watchmaking as opposed to a trade show.
Exactly. So it's exactly the our vision and our ambition is really to transform and to achieve the transformation of the ex-SIHH to a Watches and Wonders celebration of watchmaking excellence within physical events. So in Geneva, in Miami, tomorrow, I don't know, in other city in the world, but also online, with a permanent presence online with this watchesandwonders.com platform. So it will be a kind of permanent rendezvous for the whole community of Watches and Wonders fans and people interested. And then we will have physical event to relay, let's say, the presence of this online community.
Yeah, that's great. You know, I think we touched on it a little bit, but I think it's worth kind of finishing on this point is, you know, next April is going to look very different now, right? We have Watches and Wonders Geneva taking place, and then also a new show that the FHH is involved in, some kind of event. That was, you know, this week, the week we're recording this, the big news this week, right, was that Rolex, Tudor, Patek Philippe, Chanel, and Chopard have left Baselworld. And actually, as of about an hour before we hopped on the phone here, LVMH has announced that they're leaving as well. But those first five brands, part of that announcement was that they'll be doing something new, and they'll be doing it with the FHH. I wonder if you can speak to that at all, and if you can speak to kind of how you envision the broader sort of ecosystem looking in Geneva next April.
You know, Stephen, I would love to talk about that, but for the time being, it's too early. It's frankly too early because I have, frankly speaking, no idea exactly of what will happen exactly. But anyway, this is a fantastic news because I think it's a fantastic opportunity for the industry, and it's a fantastic opportunity also for Geneva because you know that Geneva. Mm-hmm. is a cradle of watchmaking. So to gather all these beautiful maison of haute horlogerie in Geneva at that time is something absolutely unprecedented. So I think it's a fantastic opportunity for everybody, and I think it's also a fantastic opportunity for the FHH because to come what we were discussing at the very beginning of this conversation, the mission of the foundation is really to gather all the stakeholders of the fine watchmaking industry and to promote their know-how, their savoir, their expertise, their values worldwide. So we are more than happy to be associated to this new initiative because it's completely in line with our mission and our ambition.
That's great. Well, thanks so much for doing this. You know, for everyone listening, we're going to be continuing to cover Watches and Wonders this week in the build-up. And then obviously on April 25th, when all the new watches drop, we'll have wall-to-wall coverage for you. And, you know, we'll continue to check in with Fabienne and your colleagues at the FHH throughout the year, I'm sure, as the situation develops. So thanks for giving us kind of the inside track here.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much for your time and see you soon.
See you soon in Geneva.
Yes, I hope. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Next up, Ben, James, and I recap Watch Madness and give you an inside look at producing talking watches. Hey guys, how you doing?
Yeah, good.
Pretty good. Pretty good.
Yeah.
Nice to see everybody's face. You guys have like big microphones. AirPods don't even work. I've got one in and it doesn't even do anything.
This is fake AirPods.
This is a professional endeavor. Yeah. But I have to admit some jealousy at Steven's over microphone coming down and in. That's something
see,
else.
It's funny.
Hey, what is that clipped onto?
There's a whole tension fit arm here that's like clipped to the side of the shelving unit on my wall. This is absurd.
Gray came over and set that up for you.
Yeah, basically. Gray ordered me a whole bunch of stuff that just showed up in a bunch of giant B&H boxes, and I got to assemble it.
It wasn't like a non-union team that came over and
no.
off about it.
Yeah, there's somebody with a giant inflatable rat right outside of my apartment, just protesting me. But. Yeah, it's Friday. It's Quarantine Friday.
Again. One more time.
Again, yeah. Yep. It's another one of these, but...
four or five, something like that?
I think so. Kind of lost track, but I think that's maybe a good thing, actually. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. It's okay.
It's a thing.
Yeah. The good news is we have some fun stuff to talk about. Watch Madness. We're recording this on Friday. Watch Madness is officially over. We have a winner. It will be announced in the next hour or two on the site. Anybody's hearing
did
this,
did I win?
It's you, yeah, actually. Yeah, it's that secret episode. Yeah.
Yeah, the secret episode. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You have to own all of our limited editions to have access to that, to that episode.
It's hosted by Eric.
Super Easter egg.
Yeah,
right, exactly. God, that would be amazing. It's over. We have a winner. We're going to talk about that. We're going to get deep into kind of how this whole thing went, some of our favorite matchups, some of the kind of unsung episodes that maybe didn't quite get their due in our not so humble opinions. But before that, because this week hasn't been crazy enough, some news broke a couple hours ago that LVMH's watch brands are also leaving Baselworld, addition to the news we got earlier this week about Rolex, Tudor, Patek, Chopard, and Chanel. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, I mean LVMH taken off. I mean, it makes sense, right? I mean, they're the other powerhouse. as Stephen astutely pointed out in his story that broke this morning, you know, Bulgari was already out. And Bulgari is a massive brand, you know. I mean, Bulgari touches jewelry as well, which is, you know, in many ways bigger than watches. So it's just Tag, Zenith, and Hublot that are out. And, you know, for those of you who haven't been to the show, those are the first brands that you see. They actually have the arguably kind of the best real estate. You know, they're right by the front door. They're right next to Rolex and Patek, effectively. And so, you know, now, you know, basically Hall One is over. Breitling's out, been out for a year. Swatch is out, been out for a year. And now Rolex, Patek, and all of LVMH is gone. So, I mean, that, you know, I asked Jack something earlier today that I probably won't repeat here, but like Basel is really struggling right now. There's no question about it. And I'm curious if they even do it, you know, if they do it, what it looks like, et cetera. But without LVMH, I mean, there's really kind of no anchor left at all.
Yeah, it's funny. I hadn't thought about the sort of like geography of the show, but you're right now. I guess like I'd have to go back and look at a map to confirm, but I think now Hall One, you could probably get 70% of the way back to the back of the hall and not hit a single booth anymore. It's kind of wild.
Exactly. I mean, at least by, you know, historical kind of layouts for sure. I mean, you know, Rolex, Patek, those guys, LVMH were always right up front. And then after that, you know, then Swatch had a huge kind of like Omega was dead center as you walked in. They were out obviously last year. Things are changing for sure.
You know, one of the things I thought was interesting, and I pointed it out in the story, is that, you know, not that long ago, even when Bulgari backed out in February, the powers that be at LVMH were saying, like, we are with Basel, we are behind this, whatever. And I think, you know, the not just the logistics and like certain brands backing out and whatever, but I think the sort of culture around it has maybe soured and become toxic. You know, they cite wanting to maintain like positive atmosphere with their clients and with their retailers. And with the press as a reason for them withdrawing. And I wonder if at this point it's just like it's become such a mess that nobody really wants to cling to it and risk getting blowback on it.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing that, you know, not to go too into the weeds, but like Baselworld is really expensive, you know, incredibly expensive.
True.
You're paying all that money to share your audience with everyone else. And frankly, if you're not Rolex, Patek, Swatch, or LVMH, you know, you're basically kind of a secondary citizen there, you know? And so, you know, I remember George Kern telling somebody or maybe saying in an interview that, you know, he can do a road show like he did 2 years ago and fly all around the world and have every press and every journalist and every retailer to, you know, kind of rap with his attention or, you know, rap to him and for a fraction of the price, you know? So it's just like, you know, if you're a Breitling or even an Omega or a Tag Heuer or, I mean, those are big brands. Think about the brands below them. Like, it just makes sense to kind of do your own thing. I mean, the Movado Group has been doing their own thing for a few years now, and I know they plan to again. AP obviously left the SIHH, which is a different thing, but, you know, they plan to do their own thing. And if you have any following at all, like, you just kind of want to say, like, hey, like, we'll just do this on our own terms, which I totally get.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll be really curious to see how the sort of like mid-sized brands at a sort of middle price point react to this, the Orises, the Nomoses of the world. Because those brands obviously, you know, don't have quite the same capital that like LVMH has to invest in something or even Breitling has to invest in something. So I'll be curious to see how those brands, you know, kind of get creative. I think that's where we'll see some real creativity because they're going to have to if they want to reach everybody.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, there's going to be obviously a stronger leaning on sites like ours, of course, and their own digital platforms, no question, social. We'll see. You know, it's interesting times in just about every way right now, you know?
Yeah, true story. All right. I think we'll leave it at that. You can go read. We'll link up the story, and I'm sure there will be more. I'm sure the dominoes are not done falling here, and we'll get more on this in the coming week. So let's leave that there and let's get into watch madness. I just want your hot takes here. Like, what are your personal reactions to how watch madness has gone before we get deep into the weeds here?
I mean, I think it's been crazy. It's the level of engagement that kind of blew me away. And then, you know, a couple of folks, and we'll definitely get into this, but a couple of folks actually like getting into the mix with the commenters and that kind of thing has been like so charming and kind of fun and like really lighthearted, which is, you know, comment sections aren't always lighthearted. Ours are typically great, but that's not a common factor on the internet. And then to see Gary and some others kind of actually, you know, being involved in that process is great. And then, I mean, just kind of the, like the general level of enthusiasm around this idea, which is, you know, it's hard to say that one Talking Watches is actually better than another because they're all distinct. They're about a person. So they're just, they're a personality story to an extent and the expression into watches. But to see people like get behind this as like a piece of entertainment, I've really enjoyed just kind of like armchair kind of basking in the glow of you know, what Will put together with all this.
Yeah. And I think we can all agree that though he is not in the final, you know, championship level matchup here, the real winner of all this is Gary Steingart, right? I mean, this guy is a champion for his engagement in the comments.
Yeah, he's incredible. Sure.
Yeah. I agree entirely.
Gary and a small cadre of other Talking Watches alums all ended up on like a group chat and were like scheming behind the scenes for all of this, which I just love that these guys were that engaged. And like, I didn't find out about it till like a week ago, I guess, you know, as we were entering the final rounds, I was chatting with Gary and he mentioned it. But yeah, these guys were like doing their own thing the whole time behind the scenes, which is awesome.
Yeah. And I think it's just like, you know, Gary is such an amazing and such like a charismatic human being. And I just think like to have his take on everything, which is so kind of like pithy and so funny and so kind of clever all the time. And in every post that we did, it was just a real delight, even from my side, just to see that happening. You know,
that's awesome. Let's do a quick recap for people who aren't aware of kind of how this ended, right? So we started out 53 episodes. There were some bye rounds. And it was a first round, a second round, then a Sweet 16, an Elite Eight, a Final Four, and then the championship. So let's start with, we'll start kind of in the later rounds here. So we have the Final Four. It came down to Gary Steingart, who we talked about, going up against the original John Mayer episode. Those two episodes, I think, in some ways, like couldn't be more different and also couldn't be more similar. It's like two guys who are like really nerdy about watches and really love them, but in like kind of different ways.
Yeah. And two guys who are like completely inside their own heads as well. You know, like they couldn't be more different in so many ways, but they're also, as you said, extremely similar. You know?
Yeah.
Two really charming personalities as well.
Yeah.
Like I think that's
real personalities, you know,
but I think that also speaks to their ability to kill their every time they had a competition is there's just this, like, there's no guard with either of them. They're just kind of like, I'm going to just, it's out. I'm doing this. It's all out. It's just pure personality. And I think it's incredible for sure. There's a commitment, I think, to being okay with the cameras and talking about your watches and all these things. And obviously that's the point from our standpoint, but that's not something that's always communicated with someone who's, or natural to someone who's on the program.
Yeah, and I think it's amazing that, frankly, Gary got to the Final Four. You know, I mean, that means he went further than, you know, Aziz Ansari and Jack Nicklaus and Mario Andretti and the second John Mayer, which is like one of the craziest things I've ever seen just as a watch person. It's pretty fun for sure.
Yeah. All right. And on the other side of the bracket, opposite those two guys, were two other incredible personalities that, again, in some ways couldn't be more similar, couldn't be more different, is John Goldberger and Jean-Claude Beaver.
Yeah, I mean, come on. That's like the heaviest of heavy hitters you could possibly imagine. You know, both those guys are like heroes to not only me, but, you know, I would say all of us, you know, anybody in the watch industry, certainly in the watch collecting industry world. That was a very, very close one, I believe.
If I'm not mistaken, it came down to single digit votes. It was real close.
Wow.
So the guys that emerged from the Final Four made it to the championship were Mayer and Goldberger, two Johns.
Two tall Johns, yeah.
Yeah, two tall Johns, exactly. Not just two Johns, two tall Johns. And that's like, I mean, these are like as classic a pair of Talking Watches episodes as you could hope for, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, these are the guys that laid the foundation, right? I mean, this was episode number one and number three, I believe, with JJ in between. And you know, it's really, you know, these are, you know, I hesitate to say, to use this word about anything we've ever done, but like, these are iconic videos, you know, these are things that, like, you know, have shaped the collecting culture over the last however many years. So it makes sense that they're both together. You know, they know each other. I've hung out with them both. You know, they have a lot of respect for one another. Couldn't be, you know, more different. You know what I mean? I mean, John is so animated and so quirky and so strange, and Goldberger is so monotone and just like very reserved. You know, John is you know, this like suburban white kid from Connecticut. And Goldberger comes from this, you know, really prominent European aristocratic family, you know, this beautiful home in Bologna, like a town home in Bologna. Just really different upbringings, you know, different kind of ideas behind what a collection is. But, you know, just two of the absolute best, no question about it. Like these guys belonged in the Final Four for sure.
Yeah, my favorite thing was, you know, when we found out these were the two final guys, I shot them each an email. I was just like, hey, you made it to the finals. Can you just give
finals of what?
Yeah, right, exactly. The funny thing is they both knew, they both responded like immediately, which was pretty funny. But I shot them each a note and was just like, hey, you're going up against the other John. Can you just give me a few words about like what you think of your competitor, your competition, as a collector, and kind of what they mean to the watch space? And each one of them said that they looked up to the other one in certain ways, and that they thought the other one should be the winner, that it was like a clear choice that it was not them. And I actually buy it. Like, I don't think it's false modesty from either of them. I think they have this amazing relationship and each really respect what the other one brings to the table, which to me is ultimately what makes this like this whole endeavor so special, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they represent two pinnacles of like two pillars that this world, you know, our world needs. I mean, one of them is like mass appeal, right? I mean, like nobody has put better watches in front of more people than John Mayer over the years. Like it's just a fact. There's not anybody, Clapton included. Like, you know, he's kind of off the grid. He doesn't post on Instagram. You don't see him wearing a great AP on stage that much anymore. So you've got this like mass exposure to like mainstream world. And then you have like a connoisseur, like an actual academic in Goldberger. You have somebody that is like actually doing research on the, you know, production numbers of Cartiers in the 1940s, things like that. So you've got these two very different kind of tenets of what the watch world needs, and combined, you know, it's a special thing for sure.
And ultimately, our winner, as probably a surprise to no one, is Mr.
James
John Mayer.
Oh,
James Stacey. Yeah,
yeah, James Stacey won. Yeah.
It's the other secret episode. It's the secret episode. Yeah, so our winner is Mr. John Mayer. I mean, that's you know, I don't think super shocking to anybody. I think it's the original episode. It started it all. I think it was probably the favorite going into this.
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
And, like, that's fine. Like, I feel like everyone can kind of, like, sleep at night knowing that he won. And, like, if you got knocked out in an earlier round or knocked out by John, like, it's okay. You can't really be upset about it.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is like that video is what launched this whole series. So you kind of have to, you know, kind of give respect where it's due there. And I think also, like, as I've said many times, and I think somebody even pointed out in the comments on this, was that like that video, I get, well, not any longer, I'm afraid, but I used to get stopped on the street when I used to go out on the street all the time and say like, hey, like that video like got me into watches, period, like straight up, you know. Yeah, not even like, it wasn't like John Mayer did it, it wasn't Hodinkee did it, it was like that particular 11 minute video or however long it is got people really excited about watches. And so I think that video deserves to be the winner here for sure. You know, winner, what does it mean? Not all that much, right? This was just a fun thing to kind of bide the time because March Madness wasn't happening and all professional sports are off. So, you know, don't put too much stock in this. This was truly just meant for fun. But I'm happy with the outcome for sure.
I was surprised that it went, I guess I expected, you know, Mayer 1 or Mayer 2 or Goldberger or Moki to just kind of cut their way through a path.
Yeah, yeah. Because
there's some people's champion element to Moki. Like, it's so awesome. And obviously, I have a huge bias there because I was the host of that episode, and I love that dude, and I always will. But right. I was in planting my seeds. I wasn't sure Mayer 1 or Mayer 2 because the size of the audience for the website was much larger by the time Mayer 2 came around, and I thought maybe that might be a whole new kind of generation of Hodinkee readers footnote for their like, and they're both great videos for sure, and I find it oddly. Uplifting, I guess, that it's Mayer 1, like the proof of concept is still something that's resonated back through this. You don't get a lot of TV shows where the pilot was the one that people go, you know what, that's the one I would vote for as my favorite episode. And I think it's killer.
Yeah, no, I agree. I thought Moki was going to go pretty far. And he did go
definitely
there.
Thought four, yeah.
But you know, the bracket was weird. You know, there were some, you know, the William Messina versus Fred Savage, you know, in the first round, the Aziz versus Wei in the first round. Like, there were a lot of things in the first round that like really kind of impacted later stuff. Like, to me, like, William, who's a good friend of mine, that was one of my favorite episodes just because I've known him and I thought the collection was great. But, you know, there's Fred Savage, you know, and Fred is just Fred. And, you know, you never know. So I think a lot of it had to do with bracketing. And I truly have no idea how that bracket was created. So thank you to whoever did that for us.
The bracket was the result. It was done numerically. So it was done based on the order in which they were published.
Hmm.
So there was no element of chance, like it wasn't pulled out of a hat, but it also wasn't purposefully set up.
Right.
But that gets us, Ben, into you know, where I wanted to go with this, which is, you know, what are some of the episodes that you think maybe got knocked out too soon, whether it's because voting was a little bit strange or whether it, you know, surprised you or just because they got a really tough early matchup?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think William would be one. I think Way would be another. You know, there was a lot of hullabaloo in the comments about Way versus Aziz. And, you know, Way's the man. I mean, he's just an awesome dude and, you know, good friend of the show and good friend of mine. I think the one thing that our audience kind of tends to forget sometimes is that our audience is not just pure, like, watch-loving dudes. And Aziz Ansari is, like, a major celebrity that is a real watch person and has, like, real sentimentality behind all of his collection. So, you know, I think Way could have gone deeper had he not had to face Aziz early on. Paramiko, like, you know, it's that collection is top two, top three for me of all time. And there's some, you know, kind of fun what ifs about that one for sure that I can share later. But like the Paramiko collection is just bananas. You know, if you look at it as like it's different categories, it's not just Rolex, like, you know, say John's would be Rolex and Patek. You know, it's much broader than even Goldberger's, you know, in terms of scale. The Paramiko collection was amazing for sure. And I could have seen that going into the Final Four as well.
Yeah, it feels, I mean, to draw an NBA comparison, right? It's like Houston and Golden State having to play each other in the Western Finals. You know, it's like whoever wins that is winning the finals, you know? And I feel like Goldberger and Paramiko having to go up against each other in the Elite Eight, like that was pretty early for that matchup to happen.
I would agree. And I think, you know, under different seeding, I think Paramiko could be in the top four for sure. Who did Moki end up losing to? I forget.
Paramiko.
Paramiko.
Yeah.
Yep,
you know, 98. I mean, it's, you know, it is what it is, right? I mean, I thought the Moki video was really something special, just like I thought the Jack Nicklaus video was something special, you know, like effectively like, you know, one guy, one watch type stuff. I thought Jack could have gone further as well, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, we're not publishing the numbers on these polls for lots of reasons, but I'm happy to say and feel totally fine saying that Moki and Paramiko came down to less than 25 votes. That was a nail biter. It was super tight. And, you know, if you look at the comments on that, it's interesting to see how passionately people feel about like one sort of collecting versus another.
Yeah.
Which I think is another nice thing that this brought out in the comments was, you know, we got to see a lot of people share kind of their own perspectives on collecting. Our readers, the people who, you know, don't get interviewed and get 12 minutes, 15 minutes to talk about it.
Yeah.
But that was able to kind of come out through commenting on other episodes.
Agreed. I thought the, you know, what's funny is in the beginning of this, I was like, huh, we'll see how, you know, we'll see if people care about this Watch Madness thing. And in the end, I love it. And I love the way that, as you said, Stephen, like people were just like, you know, so adamant that like Moki is superior to whatever, Paramiko. And it's like, okay, like what does that even mean? You know, it's just like, this is like one man's opinion about like a video. Like it doesn't, you know, it's just so funny how varied everyone's opinions are of everything, which again is why Hodinkee works and why watches work, is that like you can have guys care about watches for like dramatically different reasons, you know, like almost polar opposite. And I think we really saw that here for sure.
Yeah. I mean, James, did you have any others that you felt kind of got knocked out too soon?
I was surprised by Moki, like we've mentioned and talked about, Bayer. Was a surprise by me simply because like I feel like the mix, and I think we see this through most of the matchups, there's a mix of personality and collection, right? And this isn't surprising. This isn't like some analytical revelation, but you need kind of both to go a really long way. And that's what you see in the Mayer and Goldberger, is a mix of just insane collections and knowledge and watch love, but also like a personality that comes out on the video and connects with the person who's watching it. And I thought we had both of those in Bayer and Savage. And I'm surprised neither of them went even further. I mean, like Bayer as kind of a champion of the watch industry and Savage as kind of a champion of watch people, I think.
Yeah, I think the Bayer thing was really about like an anti-Steven vote, to be totally honest with you.
Yeah, mostly.
Just like, yeah. Fuck this guy.
Mostly, yeah, it coalesced. Yeah, I mean, you guys, I'm sure, have seen by this point the conspiracy theories about how having Gary on Hodinkee Radio and me mentioning that Gary and I had dinner a few weeks ago is that I fixed this against Alton Brown.
Oh, man, well, you got to follow the money, right? Always follow the money.
Yeah. Always follow the money. Always. That's during a really Gary's nice case, they'll like the stakes. Yeah. Yeah, right. Exactly. I'm living in Gary's guest house upstate.
Exactly. The Rene Bayer episode was awesome. I mean, like, you know, as you said, like, he's as old school as it gets, you know, getting these watches from like Hans Wilsdorf, you know, I mean, just amazing stuff. Another one that I think could have gone further just based on personality alone is Ahmed Rahman, Sherry Rahman.
For sure.
If you know him or have met him anywhere along the way, he is the most lovable, affable, friendly, welcoming human being. Like, I think I know. Like, I don't know that I know somebody nicer than him. Yeah. He's definitely way nicer than either of you, I can tell you that.
And that is like extremely true.
It's a low bar.
He's a special guy for sure.
Yeah, he was toward the top of my list. I think, you know, Tony Fadell is somebody who, like, Tony drew John Mayer, the second John Mayer video in the first round. And the moment I saw that, I was just like, oh, that sucks. You know, Tony's another, like, he might be the smartest person I've ever met. Definitely up there. Except for you. Yeah, of course. That goes without saying. Smartest, handsomest. You guys know what's up. But Tony just like super smart, great taste in watches, genuinely loves watches. I think that was a bummer matchup for me.
What do you guys think of D.D. Kim versus Reza?
Because
that's your cult of personality. You're like, he's a very obviously very famous guy and loves watches, and that's incredible. And then you have Reza, like, just the one of the most incredible collectors, a really sweet guy. Talk about a nice guy. You know, I got to do a dive watch panel with him in Heaton at H10 some time ago, lifetime ago at this point. But I thought that was an interesting matchup because it was really two absolute polar opposites in terms of their approach to watches, but obviously it's all the same general passion that brings someone into it. And I mean, good on Kim for taking the public vote. That's solid. But I was surprised to not see Reza go a bit further because I think he has a lot of the same charm we see in Mayer and Goldberger and JCB.
I would agree. I think, you know, whether, I don't know what it was, but I think maybe because when we did the talking watches with Reza, we only focused on Rolex dive watches. And I think that was really limiting for him. And to be clear, like, he's got dive watches like you've never seen in every brand, you know, new, vintage, everything, Doxas, crazy stuff, you know? And I think in some ways, people didn't really appreciate how special of a collector he is. I mean, he is the guy for all dive watches, Omegas, I mean, you name it. And I think because we focus so heavily on Rolex, people are like, oh yeah, like, this is cool. I mean, obviously Deep Sea number one is amazing. But I think, you know, if we were to do it again and we refocused on other stuff, I think he would go further.
I would love to see a Reza 2.
Pandemic, we'll do that again. You know?
Yeah. A Reza 2 with Doxa would be something fun.
Yeah. That's the most James Stacey content I've ever heard.
I was going to say, it would be like you, James Lambden, and Jason Heaton as like the only two people.
We'd be voting, though. We'd be voting. The three
be
votes
voting
locked
like crazy
in.
The three of them. We do Doxa Madness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I like it.
James, Jason, and James. Yes.
All right. So we've gotten through kind of our picks for people we think maybe got knocked out too soon. But I want to know what things surprised you guys. I definitely found myself like I wasn't keeping a super close eye on this on the back end. So, you know, we would get the new bracket every day. It would end up filled out in the CMS and I would see it. And there were days I was surprised. So I'm curious, before I talk about mine, what surprised you guys the most?
No discredit to Gary and his campaigning and his spirit and his personality, because he is just simply an amazing human being. But I am surprised that Alan, just given the social media presence that Keegan has, couldn't kind of lean a little bit and just wipe that bracket right out. That was a bit of a surprise for me, because I thought just in terms of like genuine passion and personality, like, Keegan Allen has all of it. The guy is magnetic in person. He's a really incredible dude. And I thought that it's a tough matchup because in many ways they share a very similar, like, general humanness to the way that they talk about their watches and the way they talk about themselves and that sort of thing. So it was kind of a tough matchup, but that one was definitely like for me a coin in the air, but I definitely thought it was coming down Allen. So I was a little surprised on that outcome.
I hear you. I mean, Keegan is a very popular, like just not even likable, he's a lovable person, you know?
For sure.
You know, also in really good shape, we found out.
Oh, fair.
Yeah.
No, just a great, like shoots Leica. I mean, he's totally like our guy, you know? I'm surprised also. I think, you know, Gary is just so Gary, and there's just nobody else like him.
He's special.
Yeah.
He's a special guy.
Any from you, Ben?
If Mayor 1 didn't exist, or like, let's say we like forgot to press record on that. Imagine we did that. And like that video just didn't exist. I think Mayor would have won that. I think everybody kind of knew that Mayor 1 was the favorite. So Mayor 2 kind of got knocked out. In a different routing or different routing, I could see there being two John Mayer videos in the final four.
If the path didn't necessitate Goldberger and Mayer going head to head, Mayer 2 going head to head before the final four, I agree with you. I had Goldberger as a favorite through all of this. I really think people, you know, it's one of the videos that people talk about the most, just when I meet folks. And I was kind of betting big on Goldberger.
Yeah, look, I mean, that's he's as, you know, cool as they get. I mean, there's just nobody cooler than that guy.
I think one that surprised me was our mutual friend Matt Jacobson beating Fred Savage coming out of the second round into the Sweet 16. I love Matt, and, you know, we'll talk about this later about, you know, of the collections shown, if you could swap your collection for one of the collections in a video, which would it be? And like Matt is toward the top of my list there. He's also a good friend, but Fred is just so magnetic, and I think has such, you know, kind of broad mass appeal, and his watch collecting story is something that I think a lot of people relate to. I was a little surprised there. I mean, in some ways kind of impressed at people's, you know, faith in Matt's taste and love of Matt, but I was a little surprised to see Fred taken down there.
Yeah, no, I agree on some level. I think, you know, you just have to think about like relatability of all this stuff. And I think, like, you know, Matt, even though he's, you know, his position in life and all of his success is not relatable in basically any way, he's still just a normal guy. You know, I mean, he grew up in Manhattan Beach, and like, he's just a very approachable guy, and he's not famous. And I think that's the big thing here. And I think like Fred is also like an incredibly approachable guy, but he is like, he's Fred Savage, and like everybody knows this guy, you know. And I think just the relatability aspect of choosing somebody that has done exceptionally well for themselves, and Matt has impeccable taste, you know, has this mantra of one in, one out, which I know people love. You know, I could just see that being like, all right, like this guy is a little bit more relatable because he's not a television star, you know.
Yeah, that's fair. It's totally
fair. Fred, come on, Fred is Fred. Yeah.
Yeah, completely. All right, so we'll keep this moving. If you could have seen any head-to-head matchup, you know, forget the bracket, right? Like, what would have been your dream matchup in the final? And it could be in the finals, or it could be just like a fun matchup earlier in the tournament.
I see this as almost like if you could have the two guys sit in the same video and just talk about watches. Yeah. And there's no question for me, the two that come up in my mind are Mayer JCB would be just the best. Because like
both like frantic
for the,
you know?
Yeah,
for the people listening to this and not watching this on YouTube, Ben, the smile on Ben's face the moment James said that, I think like broke the edges of the Zoom recording here.
Yeah. I mean to have, because they're both huge energies, but they're entirely different energies. You know, like Mayer has this calmness about him, especially if you're into his social media and the way that he kind of offers his kindness forward. And then I've had the great pleasure of being in several meetings that Jean-Claude Biver kind of burst into, like
that is what he does. He doesn't enter a room. He bursts in.
He bursts in like a third act in a great play, and he's suddenly there, and suddenly the tone has changed, and he's very loving and very like he can be very focused on one thing, or he can kind of be pitching to the whole room. I think that video would be bonkers. And then the other one that I'd like, and this is more of not a power matchup, but just a complete difference in what I perceive as perspective, and I don't know either of these guys that well, would be Gary and Roger Smith.
Mm. Ooh, interesting.
I think it'd be fun to have those two guys come, like, talk about watches from each of their own perspectives, because I think we're seeing, like, a very disparate sort of route into the same sort of love.
Yeah. Mm. In a weird way, I'd love to see, like, John Mayer circa 2013 versus John Mayer 2019. You know?
What do you think that would do to John's brain?
Oh, man. Like, he's gonna see this or hear this later and, like, think about that for, like, 4 days, you know?
Well, we have the technology. We could kind of make that happen.
Exactly. I think seeing Wei versus William, you know, Wei and William, to me, are kind of like, they're the watch industry. You know, they're just, like, they're both total insiders. They both have, like, dramatically different personalities. You know, Wei is like, let's just hang out with everyone. William's like, I fucking hate everyone, you know, but in, like, his own charming way. And they both have Debathoons. Like, they're both real watch guys, you know, almost, you know, at least contemporary watch guys. I'd like to see that one. What else? I think seeing Paramico and Goldberger on the same screen at the same time would be cool. You know, I've obviously known them. They're often in the same room. They're friends. That would be a cool one for sure. Just, like, so suave and so well-dressed and so Italian.
Yeah. You know, there'd be so much, like, chic Italian energy going on in that that video.
Yeah, I agree.
Good jackets. There'd be a good jacket energy, I'm sure.
Oh, my God. The Blazers would be out of control for sure.
Yeah, right.
I think for me, you know, one of them, and it sounds like an obvious one, but Gary and Fred would be amazing.
That would be high energy.
Mostly because of the comments. Like, could you imagine if the two of them had gone head to head, what the comment section on that post would look like?
That's a lot.
Ben is now just shaking his head. I think seeing those two guys, especially because they're friends and they talk about watches all the time together, I think would just be super, super fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
All right, so the last thing I want to ask before we get into some more, like, behind the scenes talking watches stuff, but the last thing about the bracket really, is what do you think was the toughest matchup for you to vote on? Like, which one did you find yourself like, oh, I'm gonna take 10 minutes, I'm gonna rewatch these videos, you know, before casting your vote?
I hate to say it for me, but it was the final round, you know. I mean, these guys, as I said, these guys are, they're two not only great friends, but great supporters of Hodinkee and great just advocates for the entire watch world, you know, and they're both so different and so cool and have meant so much to all of us, you know, so I would, you know, it's expected, but the championship round was really a difficult one for me.
Yeah, I'd echo what Ben say, and then also add, you know, I was following my boy Moki through the branch, and the Bayer Paramico one was where I went back and actually again rewatched those videos, which I'd watched them because both of those fell in kind of my bracket or my set of brackets for a previous podcast, but I thought I'd give them both another chance and try not to come at it with too much of a, like, who could I pick that would kind of be most easily dealt with by Moki, and it turns out, you know, Paramico did well.
So I just thought of another one that actually really gave me pause, and that was Andretti versus Jack Nicklaus.
Oh yeah.
And I mean, like, these are right now anyway, I'm super into golf for whatever reason. I've always been really into cars. Like, these are the guys, you know? And they both just have, like, they both kind of have similar auras. Like, they're both just, like, fierce, fierce competitors, you know? I forget if we did this on the podcast or not, but, like, who do you think would be better, like, if they were forced to pick up the other one's sport, you know? Like, that's just, like, this. They would both try really, really hard, you know? Like, they would both really get into it. That was a very difficult one for me, for sure.
As a follow-up to that thought, I thought about this after we recorded that several podcasts ago, but would you be really surprised if you found out that, like, Jack Nicklaus was also a pretty talented race car driver, or Mario Andretti was also a pretty talented golfer? Like, not really.
I would almost guarantee it, you know? Like, I would almost
not at all.
Like, I feel like you could hand these guys almost any sport. You could make up a new sport and explain it to them, and they would, like, think for a few minutes and then immediately become in the top 5% of those who have ever touched the said tools of that sport.
Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, it's just
some people are just winners, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Athletes are athletes. These guys are winners. That's true.
Yeah. All right. So I had two matchups, and they were both in the Elite Eight round. I found the one I was accused of fixing, Alton Brown, Gary Steingart, really, really tough. And then I also found Jean-Claude Beaver, Roger Smith, really tough. In the case of Alton and Gary, you know, Gary is, as everyone knows, a friend. And he and I have extremely similar taste in watches, like very, very similar. Our collections overlap in multiple ways. And then Alton is somebody I've admired for a long time. I've had the pleasure of meeting him a few times and corresponding with him a few times. I love cooking, and I basically learned to cook from watching Alton Brown on like late night reruns on Food Network. And I think both of those guys just have such a like genuine passion for watches, and it's a genuine passion in a way that's very like day to day. Like watches aren't like a separate thing that they do sometimes. Watches are like a part of how they approach every day of their lives, which I think is really relatable and nice. And then on the other side, we have Jean-Claude Beaver, have JCB and Roger Smith, who are two titans of the watch industry in completely opposite ways. And they have completely opposite affects and very opposite collections. But I found choosing between those guys really tough because it almost meant choosing between two sides of watches. And there are two sides that I love and respect. So, yeah, those were the toughest two, I think, for me.
Yeah, the Alton-Gary one is a very good one, for sure. That was tough.
Yeah. Let's, while I've got you guys here, you've both been involved in shooting a lot of these. I mean, for a long time, Ben, you hosted every episode. And then since then, it's been a mix now for the last couple years of us kind of rotating through whoever, you know, we think is the best fit or whoever's on deck to host these. So I wanted to start, Ben, with the early episodes. Do you have any fond memories from these early episodes? I mean, we saw that the earlier episodes kind of, you know, tended to do better in this bracket, and there's just something special about them.
Yeah, no, we've kind of talked about the earliest few a lot, you know, over, so I'll try to not rehash those. But I mean, the first few episodes, John, JJ, and John Goldberger were, you know, it was just like lightning in a bottle type stuff, like just seeing, like throwing stuff out there, seeing what happens. You know, the Paramico one, you know, I think back on and like that one, you know, I think this might be a question you have planned for later, but I'll talk about it now. Like that was the one where we almost had the best watch ever in the video and then didn't. And that was just like, fuck, you know, like basically Paramico had this watch that is like considered by many, including people we've discussed here, to be like top three watches of all time, like individual, like solitary watches of all time. And something happened where like we couldn't, he had sold it like a month before, or like we were delayed in filming or something like that. But we were this close to having, like, in my opinion, like top three wristwatch of all time in the video, which really would have changed everything. The Paramico video is so awesome as is, and I think back on that collection often. But this one really, like, this was close to being like ridiculous, totally ridiculous.
Yeah, I think, you know, my memories of being a part of those early episodes where I was there for recording a lot of them, your description of them as lightning in a bottle is kind of perfect. You know, like we didn't really know any better at the time, so we were winging it a little bit, and we would show up and like we would prep and we'd talk to these folks and figure out what watches, but then like we would get to wherever we were shooting and just like the vibe and the energy, and once the watches came out, like they just kind of took off, you know, and Will, you know, did an amazing job kind of capturing that energy. And you know, to me, when I watched those episodes,
all the water glass shots.
Yeah, all the water glass shots. Those are great. We can insert some water glass B-roll here right now. But
it's his lens flare.
Yeah. Oh, it's so good. But like watching those videos, like it captures a moment in time of Hodinkee for me, like a way we did things and an energy and a vibe. And I think it does that maybe for longtime readers and watchers and listeners too.
Yeah, and the other one that I forgot to mention but shouldn't is Jason Singer. You know, Jason Singer was, I still have, he holds a special place in my heart because I'm obviously extremely American. And like, you know, there was just, for the longest time, there was really nobody that represented like the American in this incredibly kind of like, you know, Franco-centric or Italian-centric hobby. And Jason Singer has been a top tier collector for half a generation. You know, he's been doing this since the early 80s. I guess that would make it a generation, like, and you know, that collection was just so absurd. And the fact that like this guy lives in the middle of nowhere, being Arizona, you know, relative to New York or LA, because nothing else matters if you're not on a coast. I don't know if you
right care. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
You know, he pulled out his collection, we're just like, holy fuck. You know, I mean, this is just like as good as like the best of the best. And he is such, like, you know, myself and I think you guys and a lot of these guys, like part of it is the collecting. They're like, okay, I want to find a great watch, and I'm, but it also like, okay, Jean-Claude Beaver bought an AP because he used to work at AP, you know. Jason is different. Jason's like, I just want the best things. I care about quality above all else. I care about rarity above all else. And like, you know, he used to, and I think still might, he would measure the thickness of lugs on Pateks to make sure that they haven't polished. Like, we're talking like that level. It's not just like, can I eye it? Can I see original finish? It's like he would actually measure it like with a micron level caliper. I mean, he's just a different level of like, he's a real collector. Whereas a lot of these other guys, including myself, are like, it's fun. Like, it's a fun thing. And like, yeah, a great mint watch is going to get me excited. But like, Jason is a true academic level, you know, intellectual collector. He was a great one.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder, James, from these early episodes, is there, if you could pick one where you could have just like been a fly on the wall, you know, been sitting in the case of, you know, like John Mayer's original episode, be sitting and having lunch on the other side of the bar.
Sure.
Which episode would that be for you?
JCB. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I adore his personality. I love that he's 100%. And when you start to think about the effect he's had on the watch industry, and then not to just be that it was a business concern, like then you see the evidence of his actual passion in things that he's decided to call his own, and dedicate, you know, some of his wealth to, and that sort of things. And he's just he has a. I don't think he would mind me saying this. I certainly don't think he would even know who I am. But, you know, like he has a sort of like grandpa charm that I absolutely adore. When he enters a room, it's his room for that time. He's put in the work. Listen to him talk. He's going to say some friendly stuff. He always has some insight. And like, look at the effect. Look at where he moved around in the industry and where those brands are now. And I think seeing that in on a table of watches, it's an insane amount of respect. And there's also like credit to Ben. I don't think he'd be the easiest guy to sit down with and have any control over the conversation at all. I think it looks that way in the video, but like, I think at a certain point, like the dice are in the air and you just kind of, you hope that they come down in your favor. And with that video, I think it was a very sweet video. It was a portrait of a man that adores watches to the extent that he's essentially devoted not only his life to this cool collection, but also to the industry at large, to the Swiss watch industry at large. And I think that's one of my most favorites.
I would agree. And I think like, you know, I think I know I've shared this story before, but I mean, the genesis of that video was like early days, you know, Hublot and Hodinkee just like did not get along. Like it just wasn't our thing, you know? And Jean-Claude back in 2012 said, hey, like, you know, I've seen what you guys do. I love it. Like, how come you guys don't feature Hublot more? And I was like, I gotta be honest, like it's just not our thing. Nothing against it, it's just not our thing. But I had heard through somebody that he was a big Patek collector. Asked him about that. He said, oh yeah, like I love it, I'd love to show you sometime. And I was like, well, how about we do a video on you instead of Hublot? And he said, okay, fine. And so we talked about the collection, and I just remember, I mean, keep in mind, he was ahead of watches for LVMH, like major, I mean, still is major group. And I was like, you're okay talking almost exclusively about a competitor? And he's like, yeah, that's fine. Like, it's my collection, you know? And at that point, I realized, like, he was effectively different than every other Swiss executive, for sure, because they would never, ever do that, you know? And we go there, and he spends an hour or more, really, you know, edited down, of course, talking about Patek, AP. I mean, I confront him very explicitly and say, like, hey, the Big Bang looks just like the offshore. He's like, yeah, like, of course it does. You know, I mean, like, can you imagine any other executive saying that ever, you know, in the Swiss watch world? Like, never. And I think that in many ways, you know, really, it really built our relationship, you know, mine with Jean-Claude and with Hublot, for sure. And certainly, like, introduced this legend who was always a legend. We had nothing to do with making him a legend. It reintroduced him to our generation. Like, I don't think people really understood how fucking this guy was before that video, you know?
Agreed. Yeah.
So legit.
And one of the coolest things is, like, he's been kind of a member of the Hodinkee family ever since, right? Like, he came and he flew into New York for a day to speak at H10. And, you know, he's, you know, really been a part of our story. And we've been kind of fortunate to get to be a little bit tiny part of his story over the last, you know, 6 or 7 years now.
The other thing, I think, again, without, you know, giving us too much credit, it's like John Goldberger was effectively an unknown, you know, unless you were like part of the auction scene or even the really dealer scene. Jason Singer was for sure an unknown and really made a point of being like off the grid. Matt Jacobson, you know, a lot of these guys were really kind of unknown and really trusted us to kind of be the first to tell their story in this way, which is really risky, you know, and I get it. You know, I understand why there are reservations. Like, you're basically saying, like, look, I'm really successful. I have spent in some cases, an ungodly amount of money on things that don't mean anything to most people. And so they trusted us to tell those stories. And I think, you know, we've done right by them for sure. And this is a very special kind of community that would support it for sure. But I think, you know, yeah. Now everybody knows who Goldberger is. Everybody knows who Jason Singer is and Matt Jacobson and all these guys. But back then, I mean, it was new for me and certainly new for our audience to get to know these personalities.
Yeah, I mean, we can all speak to this, but I want to start with you, Ben. You know, James mentioned a minute ago, like, having control of the interview, and you've mentioned this idea of people trusting us to help tell their stories. And I wonder, like, how you guys and Ben, you specifically prep going into an episode of this, because it is a responsibility, and you do kind of, like, need to have a little bit of control while also giving them room, but also like framing it in such a way that people are going to react positively to it. So we set these people up for success and to be appreciated rather than, you know, torn down or misunderstood.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I think Stephen will probably guess this, but like, I don't do any real prep because, you know, I mean, that's for losers. I think it's just, you know, primarily it's about making these people feel comfortable and having them understand that like, this is the real world, but it's also not the real world. Like, this is a microcosm for sure. And we do everything we can to make sure that they're appreciated for all that they are. And, you know, Will, who you mentioned, has done a great job editing. And you know, I can't tell you how many notes I've received after these videos go live and just be like, wow, like I don't sound half that good in my normal conversation. How did you guys make me sound that good? You know? So we're not manufacturing anything. It's just like we're highlighting the strengths of people and their collections and making it fun and carefree. And, you know, as something to celebrate as opposed to something kind of, you know, looked down upon or otherwise.
Yeah. James, is it the same for you?
On the possible flip side of Ben, like I prepare excessively for the few talking watches that I've done, but that's also like Ben and I
never have guessed that for the two of you.
Yeah, I mean Ben and I also come at it from a different level. Ben is a hardcore collector with a huge knowledge base, like a wide ranging huge knowledge base and understanding of both like taste and specific models. And I came into watches very much at a product level, say 10 years ago. So I'm still developing that back history. So if you want to talk, what you got there? An Apple Watch, okay.
Yeah, talking about like levels.
I kind of enter that differently. And I see these as, not unlike what Ben said, I see these as profiles of personality, because that's what watch collecting is. That's what car collecting is. That's what art collecting is. It's an expression of what's inside you, your personal taste, your temperament, your ability to connect with times that aren't your own in many ways, you know, a lot, especially when you get into vintage watches or, you know, well, vintage cars, the same thing. And all I want to do is know enough about somebody that when they answer a question, I can have some sort of a thoughtful response. I don't want to say that much. I definitely don't want to say that much. You know, Gray, who's on this recording and just not visible, he knows that when you give me 3 sentences to say in a row, it will take me 35 tries to get them in the correct order. and often it's in like 40, you know, 105 degree heat, in you know, in some sunny location where we shoot these things. Mostly my goal with these is always just, can you get out of the way of the person so that their personality can just kind of shine through? And once they're comfortable, they're just going to pour out their love of these watches. And I think that's all that someone watching wants to see. They don't want to see me talk like at all. You can't do this without a host. So you have to be there. But
yeah, it's funny you say that. Like, that's kind of how I measure after a shoot, how successful it was, is like the less I talked, the better the episode's going to be, you know,
for sure.
Because the more the person we already discussed those. I'm getting the veto here, but yeah, the less I talk, the better. Like, nobody's going to be able to tell that person's story better than them. Nobody's going to be able to show their excitement and their passions better than them. And if I can get them to a point where they feel comfortable just sharing, and like, I don't need to ask them, you know, question, answer, question, answer, question, answer, you know, for every sentence, like, all the better. And the way I prep for that is by researching the people generally, not their watches. Like, I have enough watch knowledge. I can figure that out usually. But by researching the people, like, hopefully I can relate to them a little bit and we can have like a real human conversation, and not a like questions 1 through 12 interview about watches sitting on a table.
Another video I want to give a quick shout out to that we haven't talked about is Ronnie Madvani. You know, I know that's a favorite of Gary's. Like, that is just like, that's a collection. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of these are just like, all right, here's a grouping of watches. That is like a tight, tight collection.
That's very true. So I've got two more questions. Of all the Talking Watches episodes, if you had to swap for one of the collections, which one would it be? You give up all your watches, but you get the Talking Watches collection. Whose collection are you taking?
For me, it's easy, but James, you want to go first?
I'll go first. Yeah, I would say Reza. Give me Reza's collection. But I want the stuff that was off camera as well.
You want it all?
Yeah, I mean, okay.
Yeah, give me, well, it's the collection, right? If he's getting my like eight watches, like it's only fair.
All right.
Yeah, I adore the guy. I like the level of passion that he has for kind of a specific thing, and yeah, it'd be Reza. You know, Mayer too. Some pretty incredible stuff in there. And then I don't want to step on what I believe that, Ben's.
I was going to say I could see you wearing that 6270, that Daytona.
Hell yeah, right? Why not? Or you know, he's got a 5164A on a brown or on the green, which is a dream of mine. Like he's got some solid stuff, and I'm not going to step on what I think will be Ben's answer. So I'll let him pick it up.
What do you think is my answer?
Singer.
Actually no, but close. Close. Okay. I mean, I would die to have one of his watches, but yeah.
Right? Yeah.
All Singer's right. Whose collection are you taking, Ben?
Well, it's Goldberger. There's no question about it. Like he's, you know, I've said this in writing, like he's my idol. As a collector, you know, he has taught me so much. Like there are actually when we produced that video, you know, he had those three split second, the Universal, the Minerva and the capped chronograph. I was wearing my Henry Graves, Universal. And I just started like really falling in love with the Corelli split. I now own one. I mean, I bought that truly because of that afternoon with him. He has that, white gold perpetual, Breguet that's kind of rectangular.
Oh. I have that watch.
Yeah, it's amazing. I have a Jumbauer Breguet that is kind of in the same production line as that. You know, I mean, he is an inspiration for that for sure. So, not even to talk about the white gold 6265, which is absurd. You know, it's just like, it's just not a thing. And the one thing I was thinking about why I might not want that collection is like, you know, I love the early stuff, the 30s and 40s, the step bezel stuff and like those Longines 13ZN and sector dials and all that. But at the end of the day, like, when I'm kicking around, like I do want to wear like a Rolex Oyster watch or like, you know, a waterproof Omega, like a Speedmaster or Seamaster, whatever. And I was like, shit, Goldberger doesn't really have that in his collection. But then I remember the white gold they don't, which has a screw down crown in white gold.
I love that that's going to be your kicking around watch.
Yeah. I mean, come on. If you're Goldberger, that's what you do, you know?
It's true.
But I think also like, you know, that's absurd and, you know, at like, you know, the very pinnacle of some mountaintop of collecting. I think John Mayer, episode one, like, come on, that's just like, it's blue chip stuff. You can't, you know, it's a 5970, it's a mil sub, it's a 6263. Like you could kind of stop with those three watches right there, you know? And similarly, the Paramico collection, you know, the watch that I'm referring to that like didn't get shown in that collection, what was like basically 30 days away from being featured was the JB Champion, unique watch, which is like, you know, That sold for more than the Clapton Platinum 2499 at auction. Like it is considered by many like one of the greatest watches ever made. And Alfredo owned that watch up until like, you know, 30 days before we did that video. So that would be up there as well for sure.
Yeah. How about you, Steven?
So, you know, my instinct at first was to maybe say Gary's collection, but I realized that's because it's basically a collection of watches that like I either currently own, have owned, or like I'm on the verge of owning. So I'm going to let that slide because that's basically just saying like, I wouldn't change anything. I think I would take Matt Jacobson's collection.
Great choice.
I like that it's a tight collection. I like that it's like really well edited, which appeals to me. It's a mix of like vintage Rolex. He's got, you know, the 3700 Nautilus that's in like unbelievable condition, about as good a condition as you would want to actually still wear it. Which is important. But then he's got weird stuff. Like he's got the Beta 21s, which I just love, you know, those Patek's, they're huge. They're heavy. They're on removable bracelets that like, as he says in the video, like he can't figure out how the bracelets were made. They're just so weird. Which I find appealing that there's something like that in the collection. A mix of Rolex sport watches. And then if we're talking about stuff that's outside the collection, or was outside the video, you know, I know Matt has acquired quite a few things since, some really beautiful Daytonas, other Rolex sport models, and then a Creedor, an Ichi, which we mm-hmm. talked about when we had him on Hodinkee Radio. And to me, that watch actually is what like tips it for me, is to have a collection that has like great vintage Rolex, great vintage Patek, 2526, 3448, like really incredible, like beautiful minimalist stuff. Oh yeah, there we go. Ben's just killing me here with this white gold 2526.
I won't sell it without coming to you first, I promise.
I appreciate that. That's all I've asked. That to me is just like, it feels like a very me collection. So I think I'll go for fit over like pure quantity and like objective quality there.
Jason, and now that you know, I've been thinking about what you said, James, like the Jason Singer collection was absurd. And now, obviously, I know the other watches that he has and since, since purchased, and just absurd. Sorry, I wish I had headphones in, but I don't. Just absurd stuff, you know, I mean, really, yes. Like the best of the best of the best. I mean, his white gold 3448, which he now is on crazy. A bracelet, just like, come on. I mean, that's a dream, you know?
Yeah, yeah, the Singer collection was my natural answer, and then I wanted to make sure we had some variety, so I went with a couple there. But I mean, Singers. I mean, if you give a collection like that to a guy like me, I sit down and just learn about each one. It'd be a whole. Yeah. You'd have an education. That's a 4-year degree in incredible watches.
Yeah.
Just really cool stuff. Really thoughtful.
For sure.
All right, so to wrap things up here, I got a question for you, Ben. You know, you talking watches is your and Will's brilliant creation here. You know, you've been deeply a part of it since before episode one. We're now 53 in. You've got a whole team of people making episodes now, multiple yeah. producers, multiple hosts, the whole thing. Where do you want to see it go from here? Like, if you could come back in 5 years and see what talking watches is like, what would you hope it looks like?
Yeah, I'd love to figure out a way to get more... first of all, to do more of them. You know, I think this is our number one requested editorial product by a country mile. You know, people just want this all the time. It is very difficult to produce. I mean, much more so than I think people really understand, at least to our standards or the standards that we've imposed upon ourselves. So there's certainly more of them. And I think, you know, just really striking a really great balance of celebrity and real people. You know, we often tell stories of great sentimental watches. You know, we typically write those stories. But I think we could use this format to tell them in meaningful ways. The Moki video was a great example. You know, the Long Return, which was not a talking watches, could have been, you know, in a weird way. There are things that we produced that have been really wonderful and a little bit more kind of like human. And we didn't put those in the talking watches category. Maybe we should have. So I think, you know, focusing more on a little bit more real life stuff, as well as, you know, the crazy stuff. And like, you know, there's some guys that we know are out there that we just have to get around to filming. You know, they're mostly in Europe, you know, arguably the biggest vintage watch collector in the world, we know. And, you know, we'll be getting to that at some point. There's Ed Sheeran, which we know we'll get to at some point. You know, there's some bangers that are like right on the edge of occurring. Yeah. It's just a matter of making the time. You know, first of all, being able to leave your house, you know, that would be helpful.
That helps, yeah.
And then beyond that, being able to get in a car and get on an airplane. But you know, it's the one thing I would just want to remind people of is that, like, you know, this is like, none of these videos are sponsored at all in any way. Like, there's not a dollar coming to us for doing this stuff. Like, we just do this because it's the best content there is. And I know that doesn't seem like any great notion, but like, this stuff is incredibly expensive and incredibly time consuming, and it's a lot, you know. So I wish we could figure out a way to kind of do more of them without deviating from the products that actually do kind of pay all of our salaries, you know. And it's really tricky. I think we found a good balance, but you know, I would love to be able to do more of them and have people, like, I'd love to have a team dedicated to talking watches full time. I mean, make it a series, you know. But you know, maybe with time, you know, the business is doing okay. So who knows, you know?
There we go. Awesome. Well, if you're listening to this or watching this on YouTube, check out the comments, let us know your favorite episodes. Feel free to answer any of the questions we talked about today. Like we've said before, like, the best part of doing this is, talking about it with all of you guys. Ben's waving watches at the screen there.
So I've got, so but, I, So I've got, you know, watches on my desk here, and it's just like, I'm just looking at them talking to you guys.
We're doing an impromptu Ben Clymer talking watches now?
Yeah, I mean, this is not anything you know about, but this watch is so good.
Yeah, I've honestly, that might be the watch I'm wearing most while working from home.
Yeah, it's a really good one.
Awesome. Thank you guys for doing this and for making Watch Madness so awesome. And yeah, we'll have you back on. We'll talk again soon.
See ya.
Take care.
And to take us home this week, we've got our own John Bewes talking about his favorite work from home watch.
This is John Bewes here. Gray asked me to hop on Hodinkee Radio this morning to tell you about the watch that I've been wearing while working from home. For me, it's been just one. Each day for about 6 weeks, I've raised my left wrist and seen the same watch. It's a Rolex GMT Master 2. This kind of uninterrupted wrist time isn't totally uncommon for me. While plenty of friends and colleagues find satisfaction in changing their watches each morning, I tend to wear mine for longer stretches. Chalk it up to laziness, or the overabundance of caution that's caused me to keep my watches at the bank. A watch in my collection might draw my attention for any number of reasons. Formality might call for my early 60s IWC Caliber 89. The desire to view a perfect dial and changing light might have me reaching for my Grand Seiko. Or a beach weekend might mean it's time for my Tudor Black Bay 58. Oh, to have those occasions to look forward to. Or it could be a story I'm working on, in the inspiration I hope to gain from having a certain watch ticking on my wrist. Whatever it may be, the watch I choose tends to stay with me for maybe a month or so. I started wearing my GMT Master 2 for inspiration. I was writing my longest piece of watch journalism to date, the recently published Reference Points, Understanding the Rolex GMT Master. And I wanted to tap into what this watch means to me as much as what it means to the larger collector community. I had a feeling wearing my Batman would help me along as I went deep into an important part of the Rolex story. And I think it did help. Purchased last July, my Batman is a watch that drew me in mostly from a design standpoint. Its black and blue bezel insert being my favorite color combination of all the Cerachrome GMT Master 2s, and its Jubilee bracelet converting me from a dyed-in-the-leather strap guy to someone who started to lean toward bracelets, as long as they're the right bracelets. A Rolex GMT is a travel watch, of course, and I hope to put mine to its intended use once COVID-19 is a distant memory. But I also think a Rolex GMT makes a fine contender as a daily wearer. I sometimes think of the great photographer Bruce Talamon's reference 1675, which he talks about in a Hodinkee magazine column titled One Man, One Watch, when I wear my GMT. I hope to attach meaningful memories to my GMT the way he has to his. The fact that mine's longest stretch of continuous wrist time coincides with the most sedentary period of my life is not lost on me. This was a watch born to go places, after all. Like most of us who are fortunate enough to work from home during this difficult time, my morning starts with waking up, figuring out breakfast, and then staying put. Zoom meetings with an upbeat core of colleagues are the highlights of my days. When I occasionally venture out, it's with a mask covering my face in a travel-sized container of precious Purell tucked in my pocket. The rest of my watches are sequestered in a safety deposit box at the bank. And while accessing them occasionally feels like it might be an essential activity, like buying food, I obviously know better than that. For now, I'll continue to wear my GMT happily as I work from home, the local hour pegged to New York time. I look forward to going places and making new memories with this watch on my wrist when the time is right. Stay safe and enjoy your watches. See you on the other side.
This week's episode was recorded remotely by our group of editors and was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference for us. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.